Hello and welcome to episode 2 of the HTML5 mobile podcast. The first episode seemed to go over pretty well. I had a bit of support and people giving some feedback, and a few of you seem to be enjoying it. So for the short term, at least, I'm going to keep doing these. In this episode, I have a chat to Mike Hartington from the Ionic team about Ionic 2. And we're also going to cover a bit of news and brief stuff as well. One of the biggest stories since the last podcast is that the alpha preview of Ionic 2 has finally been released. This is very exciting news. Obviously, we can start getting our hands dirty with some Ionic 2 stuff and looking at how all that works. I'll link to some blog posts you can take a look at to get Ionic 2 set up on your machine. You'll need to update the command line interface to create a new Ionic 2 project. And I've also been creating some Ionic 2 tutorials as well as video tutorials that you can check out to start seeing how everything works. I think I've got, at this point, I'll have a to-do application tutorial and one on using maps in Ionic 2 as well. So check those out, and I'll be putting out plenty more of those in the future as well. Ionic 2 isn't ready to be used in production applications just yet, and it won't be for a little while. This is an alpha, obviously, so right now it's all about just testing it, making sure it's all working as it should be. So there's probably going to be a few bugs and stuff still around, and it's heavily tied into Angular 2 as well, and that is still in alpha. So things could change from now until it's released, so don't use it for production applications or anything like that, but do start using it now. Have a play around with it so that when the beta release does come, you can look at actually creating real applications with it and maybe switching over from Ionic 1. There's certainly a few reasons why you might want to do that. And we'll cover some of those reasons in the chat I have with Mike a little later on in this episode. Still on the topic of Ionic, they've also recently just announced the Ionic package service. What this will be is essentially a tool that you can use to build iOS and Android applications. So the actual installable files, the APKs, the IPAs for iOS. This service will be similar to what PhoneGap Build does, basically. So usually if you want to build iOS or Android applications on your machine, you have to have the SDKs installed. In the case of iOS, that means that you need to have a Mac to have those SDKs. So what this sort of service does is it handles all of that compilation for you. It builds the final build packages without you having to have the SDKs installed. So PhoneGap Build does a similar thing. And basically it's going to be, I guess, competing with PhoneGap Build in that sense. But it seems quite easy to use. I haven't actually tested it out myself yet, but you can essentially just run a command that's basically Ionic package build iOS or Android from the command line, and it will handle building it for you. And in the case of iOS, obviously, you're still going to need to create those provisioning profiles and certificates and have a Apple developer account and all that stuff. So it's not going to solve all of your problems, but it certainly could be a very good option, especially for people who don't have a Mac and want to create iOS applications. During the alpha period of this service, just like all the other services that Ionic have been putting out recently, it'll be free, and then they'll move to a paid model after that, based on usage. So it'll be a tiered pricing model. But there'll also be a free tier for development as well. I really like what Ionic's doing with all these services that they've been creating with the Ionic package now, but also the deploy service for updating apps without having to go through the Apple review process again, analytics, the push notification service. I'm probably missing a couple other things they've put out as well. But basically, they've just been putting a ton of effort into creating these services, which are going to make our lives easier as developers. And obviously, as a company, Arnik needs to make money to survive. So that's what these services are going to do for Arnik. But it's important to remember that Arnik itself, the Arnik framework, is in a way that will be free. You won't have to pay to use that. You only need to pay to use these extra services like push notifications and analytics and that kind of stuff, which I think is a really cool approach and really developer friendly. Google has just recently announced that they're going to start indexing, or rather they have started indexing iOS 9 apps that support the HTTP deep linking standards. So basically what this will do is allow users to find content that's within applications. So I think I heard an example somewhere about if you have a cooking application that has some recipes in there, a user would be able to go through Google, search for some stuff that's in your application, open those search results, and then that would launch directly in your application rather than having to go to a web page instead, which obviously is a really, really cool and powerful opportunity, basically. I think this was already supported in Android already, but well, now it's supported in iOS 9 as well. So that's going to be awesome. I think there was Max Lynch did a post on this, and there was some chatter about how Arnik would be go about supporting this. So hopefully that's something we'll see in the not too distant future, and we can start playing around with that as well. I'll link to the blog post that Max made for that, so you can check that out for yourself. If you've been around the mobile web app scene, then you've probably come across the dreaded tap delay at some point. I've done a blog post about this before and some ways to deal with that. But basically, for mobile web apps, it's the effect where there's a 300 millisecond delay for taps. And essentially, this is to so the browser can figure out whether this is going to be a double tap rather than a single tap. But that slight delay is kind of noticeable and makes apps feel like they're not native apps. It's a pretty tiny difference, but it really does make it feel a lot less smooth. But WebKit has just announced that essentially they're removing this tap delay for web pages with unscalable viewports. So what that means basically is viewports that have the, I forget what the exact attribute is called, user scaling, I think it is, on the viewport, where you can do the pinch to zoom in and zoom out on a web page. If that isn't active, then the tap delay won't exist, basically. So some people are worried that this might mean that it's going to be bad for accessibility. People sort of now have an incentive to disable that zooming effect just to as an easy way to remove that tap delay. But I think, I mean, there's quite a bit of debate around this, but there are ways to get around this anyway already. You can use libraries like, I think it's called fastclick.js to remove that tap delay. And I guess as long as you're designing with accessibility in mind, the zooming might not always be necessary, but it is going to be important for apps to have an option where, you know, if you need to make certain elements bigger, text bigger, that people who, have vision problems, can actually still use that and they're not missing out by this change. This isn't really an issue for frameworks like Arnik and SensureTouch anyway, because this is handled by default. The tap delay is removed anyway. But I think some other frameworks, jQuery Mobile maybe, I'm not sure if they have that removed or not. That tap delay does exist. So if you do want to remove it, you needed to use things like fastclick.js or now, I guess, disable that user scaling. In the last podcast, I mentioned Interphase 1, which was created by Richard Davey, the creator of Phaser, which is a HTML5 game-making framework. So Interphase 1 was really awesome. I got that. I loved it. Basically, it goes in-depth about some technical aspects of Phaser and then has some tutorials on how to make a whole bunch of games. So that went over really well, and he's already working on Interphase 2, which is this, a similar sort of format again. It goes in-depth into a different technical aspect of Phaser and, again, has a whole bunch of games. So if you're into Phaser, definitely check that out. I think there's a pre-order discount for that now that you can grab, so I'll link to that. And I'm curious to know how many people who read my blog and listen to my stuff are actually interested in Phaser, or if they're interested in building HTML5 mobile games in general. I know there's a few of you who do read and like my Phaser stuff, but I know the majority of the people who are coming to my blog are doing that for Ionic. I love making HTML5 mobile games. I think it's a lot of fun, and I imagine a lot of people who are into building apps with Ionic, I'd say there's a good chance that they might be into game development too, but I'd just be really curious to know how many of you actually are interested in that stuff, and if you want to see me putting out more Phaser content in the future, and if you're not already using Phaser, are you interested in starting to learn it? So yeah, let me know in the comments. Okay, I'm talking to Mike Hartington now, who's the developer advocate at Ionic. You've probably seen him around the Slack channel or the forum answering everybody's questions. And he's been doing quite a bit of talking and presenting on Ionic 2 lately. So to start off with, Mike, did you just want to give us a bit of a background about yourself and what your role is at Ionic?
Cool. So I kind of jump around between every role, jack of all trades, kind of, whether it's framework development, community outreach, presentations. Now, wherever I'm needed, that's kind of where I go. But most of my work consists of just being a developer advocate and helping the community with any issues that they have and questions to have during the development process.
Okay, cool, awesome. So we're just having a little chat then. Obviously, the Ionic 2 is kind of the hot thing at the moment. It's what everyone wants to know about. So I wanted to, I guess, focus on that in this chat. But just in brief, what is Ionic 2 exactly, and how does it improve on what Ionic 1 has been doing?
So to kind of talk about Ionic 2, we have to go back like 2 years to when Ionic 1 was first kind of released in any way, shape, or form. And anything that we were doing at the time was for the devices that we had then. iOS 6, Android 4 was like the prominent Android operating system. So that was what Ionic was initially designed to do, to work with those devices that we had in 2013. Ionic 2 is essentially everything that we've learned since then and utilizing all everything that JavaScript now has to offer to create a more powerful framework that still provides the same ease of development that Ionic 1 does.
Yeah. So obviously that's very heavily tied to Angular 2 and stuff like that. But from what I've seen, there's a few changes to Ionic 2 itself. So what sort of new things can we expect from Ionic 2 in terms of the functionality that Ionic offers?
So some of the new things I think are navigation changes. It's probably one of the most drastic changes, and it kind of is a departure from what people were used to and expected in Ionic 1. And that's where Ionic 1 was super tied to UI router, and its navigation history were all tied to the browser URL. What Ionic 2 is doing is kind of putting that, switching that around. So you can navigate around inside of your app wherever you are, and then you can tell the browser, okay, I'm here, make the URL this, which is completely a different kind of concept and mental way of thinking. So it's new, it's powerful, and it's much more driven by the experience that developers want their users to have. A good way to think of it is the iOS App Store. So if you go to a specific view about an app, well, there's three or four different ways to get to that specific view, whether you're from a features tab, whether you're from a search tab. Now that we're decoupling the URL and making views kind of their own standalone thing, we can essentially just point our navigation stack to that particular view, and then we can just programmatically tell the URL what to be and not have to rewrite multiple views of the same thing to follow the URL scheme.
Yeah, I've been playing with Ionic 2 a bit, and yeah, I've tried out the new navigation system, and I really like it. It seems really sort of straightforward to use, so I'm definitely a fan of the new one. I think I've seen sort of Max Lynch mention with Ionic 2, one of the goals was sort of have this core set of functionality, I guess, and then remove all of the plug-in-y type stuff like the Tinder cards that were in Ionic 1, and I guess have this core set of functionality that's awesome, and then allow the community to build onto that. So is that more or less, am I more or less on the mark there? Is that kind of the goal for Ionic 2?
Yeah, that's pretty much on spot. What we realize is that Ionic, while those other functionalities are fun and interesting and, you know, add a lot of livelihood to an app, they don't really fit into a core framework for developing a mobile app. Those are definitely, you know, custom controls that people should be adding without having to download the entire package and carry it that way. Those are very specialized kind of components.
Yeah. One thing which I think is pretty cool about Ionic 2 is the integration with the native functionality. So there's a few things in the API now, like the this camera geolocation in Ionic 2 by default now. Whereas before we would have, you know, used stuff like NG Cordova or just used PhoneGap directly. So where does NG Cordova fit into all this? Is that something that's still going to be used, or how do we access the stuff that is in NG Cordova but that's not in Ionic 2 yet?
So NG Cordova, you know, it'll still be around for any Ionic 1 projects or any Angular 1 projects. But with Ionic 2, we're kind of moving all the, at least the core Cordova plugins, to the specific classes that you can import from the Ionic, from the V2 framework. And they essentially provide the same functionality where you can have a nice promisey syntax and handle all this native functionality. What that kind of means for other plugins that aren't essentially in the native framework, or that we don't include in the framework, maybe one in particular, the social sharing plugin. If that one's not included in the framework, well, it's a simple matter of npm install, and then someone needs to write the class for it. It's the classes that are there for the current core plugins are pretty simple, pretty straightforward. You know, the good thing about all this new TypeScript and ES6 syntax is that it's pretty easy to just take everything and repurpose it.
Yeah.
So core plugins for Cordova, camera, device, in-app browser, geolocation, yeah, expect those to be there. Anything else, any of the third-party plugins, it's a simple matter of creating a new class with some annotations for it.
Yeah, and I guess that ties back into what we're just talking about. You're sort of providing that core set of functionality, and then all of the extra stuff can just be added into the framework as it's needed, which is cool.
Yeah, Max has a nice little saying. It's like getting the flashlight and the batteries all at the same time. It's everything you need to work.
Yeah, yeah. Awesome. So yeah, you mentioned ES6 and TypeScript there. So I wanted to touch on a few of the new technologies that are used in Arnic 2 and Angular 2, because I think they probably confuse a lot of people. So maybe just briefly, like, what is ES6 and what is TypeScript?
So ES6 is essentially the, not essentially, it is the new edition of JavaScript. So the same ES5 that we've been writing for a number of years now, but includes some new features, which, depending on who you ask, make the language better or worse in some people's opinions. I think they make the language better and much more productive. We have things like classes now, which is just syntactic sugar for working with JavaScript's prototype prototype inheritance system. We have proper modules, so we're not polluting the global scope. We have things like fat arrow functions, that way we have proper lexical scoping. And we have new keywords such as let and const to actually replace var. So let will be scoped to the innermost block, where const can be a variable that you, once set, you can't change. So they provide all these new things that other languages have had for a while. And now JavaScript kind of actually has them.
Yeah.
And anyone, if you ask anyone who's been writing in ES6 for a while now, using Babel, I think it's pronounced, or some kind of transpiler, once you write ES6 code, you really never want to go back to ES5 code.
Yeah, sort of just since Arnic 2 has sort of come out, that's my first experience with ES6, and I'm really liking it so far, obviously. There's a little bit to get used to, but yeah, I'm really enjoying the syntax. As far as TypeScript goes, so you've been doing some talks on that recently, and so a lot of what ES6 now offers is what people were using TypeScript to achieve before, but TypeScript is still useful as far as I can tell. So why might people want to use TypeScript still with ES6?
So TypeScript kind of brings both some features from ES6, features from ES7 or ES2016, whatever they want to call it nowadays, from current versions of JavaScript, future versions of JavaScript, and these features of static typings. So anyone who's ever used other languages where if you have a variable of A, well, you can, once you inject that into your function, you can say that variable A has a type of number, or it's a string, or it's a boolean value. And anytime you give it something other than that, the compiler and most of the time your editor will give you a gentle reminder saying, hey, you passed me something that I was not expecting. Look at your code, figure out where the issue is, and it'll give you a nice little warning of where the issue is and where you're doing things incorrectly.
Yeah.
It has another feature which I really like. It's interfaces. So you can start annotating your classes in such a way that at at authoring time, you can reference what they call a definition file, which is an entire list of all your APIs that you have, whether it's for Angular 2, Ionic 2, or any other kind of library. And if you start importing those references and annotating your code correctly, anytime you make a call to those APIs, your editor will know what you're actually doing and be able to provide code completion. So if you can think about, in the example that I've been talking about, our loading. Loading has a show method, but it also can take a list of options. And with these reference files, you can see the show and hide method, but then you can also see show takes a list of options. And once you create an object in for your options, you can see all the available options, you know, whether how long to show the loading, the template, et cetera. All these useful things that you would probably have to go scour documentation to go find. So it's like having documentation inside of your editor.
Yeah, that's really cool. Is that I don't use TypeScript currently, but I'm using Sublime Text. Is there specific editors that work better with TypeScript, or can just about anything provide that sort of functionality?
Just about any editor. I know my main editor that I kind of use on a day-to-day basis is Vim, but Visual Studio Code has support for it right out of the box. Sublime has support for it. WebStorm, Visual Studio, the full IDE has support for it. Mm-hmm. Just about every major editor out there has support for it.
Okay, cool. And would you recommend, heavily would you recommend that an Ionic 2 developer or an Ionic developer should use TypeScript? Is it something that's provides heaps of benefits and really everyone should try and use it, or, you know, just sort of a personal preference thing?
It's a kind of a bit of both of those. Definitely a bit of a preference. If you are used to these typings and coming from C# or any other language where static typing is always there and you want that, then maybe take a look at TypeScript. But larger teams also would benefit from it as well, because you can have this code completion inside of your editor, and you have the smart way of being able to figure out if you're passing in the right variables or the right things to your functions. It keeps everyone kind of on the same page. So you could have a team of maybe 20 developers. They may not know the entire API for the specific library, but with TypeScript, they can kind of figure out which API, what it is, and, you know, how to actually use these methods.
Yeah. All right, cool. One thing I have seen a lot of hype about as far as new tech goes is a Webpack, but I mean, I don't exactly get what it is, what it does, how it's different to, say, Gulp and Grunt and those types of things. So can you explain sort of what exactly that does, how it's different, and, you know, how we might use it with Ionic 2?
So Webpack is essentially a module loader, or a module bundler. Essentially, you can use Webpack to take your ES6 modules, bundle them all together, and compile everything down to ES5, because that's what runs in the browsers today. It's along the same lines as Gulp and Grunt and all those other tools that are out there. It's just, it has a lot of traction because there's been a lot of push to use it inside of other libraries like React. They use it a lot. I'm not the best authority on it. There are some obvious benefits to it. But there is also a steep learning curve. So I'm still on the fence about it.
Yeah. Okay. So it's not something that's going to be super critical to get your head around if you want to use Ionic 2 then.
No, we're using it for transpiling down to ES5 and then creating a single bundle file.
Mm-hmm.
But the good thing about it is that you as an end user, if you don't want to look at it, you don't ever, you never have to. You can just let the CLI handle it and do its own thing.
Yeah, and that's another thing I've sort of seen some of the Arctic guys mentioning is that you kind of want to create this framework where people can just, you know, if you're new to this sort of development, you can jump in and start coding rather than having to set up, you know, Webpack and Gulp and learning how to, you know, run 10 different technologies just to start building it out, which right. I think is a really cool approach.
Yeah, there's been a lot of time put into figuring out what's the simplest approach that we can give users so that way they're not having to learn, like you said, 10 different things on top of, you know, the new framework and new languages. And it's a bit of a mess, but we're trying to do our best to make sure that it's easy for anyone to just go in there and pick it up and be productive.
Yeah. So what are the kind of things you think with Arctic 2 that people who are going to struggle, or people are going to struggle with the most? So especially people who are coming from Arctic 1, obviously it's a bit different. Are there any sort of sticking points you think people are really going to struggle with? And what would you, I suppose, what tips would you give people who are making that switch, or at least preparing to use Arctic 2?
I think so far, the things that I know, at least I struggled with when I was first learning Arctic 2 and kind of getting involved with it, was just kind of understanding that things aren't global anymore. If you need to use something from Angular, you need to make sure that you import it. You need to make sure that you declare it. It's a bit stricter as far as you can't just reference a service that you created. You have to first import that service and then actually be able to reference it inside of your code. You have to make sure that everything is properly declared, and that's just takes kind of a mental shift. You know, people need to it trips them up the first few times, but once you kind of get over, okay, everything needs to be imported, then it becomes a lot easier.
Yeah. Yes, from what I can tell, it's sort of, I mean, obviously the syntax is very different. The structure's a little different, but I mean, for the most part, when I'm sort of building stuff in Arctic 2, I'm more or less taking what I do in a controller in Arctic 1 or Angular 1, converting that into a component, writing a class definition, and I'm just putting functions in there just like I'd put functions in a controller. So the process for converting a controller in Arctic 1 to a component in Arctic 2 seems like it's, you know, going to be pretty straightforward for people to learn.
Right. And it's also a mix of your state definitions. Once you start declaring, you know, here's your template, and here's anything that, you know, your template requires, as far as services and other classes, that it kind of everything gets squished into one place now. And if you want to go further and use inline templates, you can get rid of HTML and just write everything in JavaScript. But yeah, the concept that your classes essentially your controllers in Angular 1 become classes that's a good way to think about transferring code over.
I've done some stuff on I guess the new Angular 2 syntax, and a lot of it's, you know, it's pretty similar to Angular 1. Just looks a little different. Again, I think we got, you know, ng4 instead of ng repeat and stuff like that. The event listeners are just in brackets. But one thing that I found particularly confusing, and I imagine other people would too, is that star syntax. So you got like the star, then ng4. And so I have a basic understanding of what that's doing. It's sort of creating this embedded template type thing, but I still find that whole concept a bit confusing. So I thought maybe you could talk through what that is and why we need to do that rather than, you know, just writing ng4. Why do we write star ng4 instead of just ng4?
So a good way to think of it is that those square brackets, which are handling those properties, those can be dynamic properties that, you know, you attach to that you can handle with your controller. And those are actually part of, at render time, those get attached to the actual element. And, you know, you should never see any reference to a square bracket, my property equals this dot property or whatever. Whereas these star NG4, for example, what you think about that is that NG4 is essentially a sibling, for lack of a better word, component at the template level. So NG4 will sit there at the same level as everything it's going to render. And that's where it's creating that inline template. So once you do that, you have a template, essentially a template document inside of your HTML. And then you have all the logic to handle rendering out all those dynamic elements.
Okay.
So it's a little bit of a tricky way to think about it. But once you look at the outputted code or the rendered HTML DOM, it makes sense.
Yeah, I've seen. It was the whole inspect element thing on that. And looked, I could see those, yeah, like the template tags being inserted in there. And I think that's a good point too. Like, sort of when you're looking behind the scenes, stuff starts to make sense. And obviously with Ionic 2 now, there's not a lot of documentation. I think what's there now is good. It's kind of, obviously it's not fleshed out yet, but you got links through to like the parts in the code that are doing whatever thing you're looking at. So if you go there, go to the docs, find the thing you want to work with, you can sort of look behind the scenes, see what's going on. And yeah, I've been able to figure out a few things from that. And I think it sort of helps to learn the framework, understand what's going on behind the scenes. So if anyone's having trouble with stuff, I recommend, have a look behind the scenes, see what you can figure out. I think a lot of people are probably intimidated to look into what the Ionic 2 code itself is actually doing, but you might be surprised at how much you understand.
The good thing about working with Angular 2 is that a lot of the code that we're using for Ionic 2 ends up just becoming JavaScript, and it's pretty simple to follow because there's no patterns that Angular is having to recreate. There's no dollar timeout or scope.apply. It's everything's kind of vanilla JavaScript, and you know that.
Yeah, which I think is another really cool thing about this whole Ionic 2, Angular 2 stuff is you are just writing just JavaScript. So the skills you're learning are going to be really transferable to other stuff, which I think is really cool.
Right.
So obviously, the release of Ionic 2 is going to be heavily tied to Angular 2 when that hits beta. And I imagine now there's probably not much of a sense of when that is, but is there a sort of rough timeline when you think that Ionic 2 might reach a beta status, when people might be able to start using it in real apps, I guess? Is that, is it 3 months, 6 months, a year? Is there any sort of sense about that?
No sense of it right now. If we were to put a date and not be able to follow through with it, people tend to get pretty upset. So. Yeah. It's best to say we don't know. We're going to be developing the framework as on a day-to-day basis, and when we and the Angular folks feel like both Angular and Ionic are at a stable point, then we would declare a beta. But who knows when that can be?
Yeah, and so you would, before the beta release, you wouldn't recommend people use Ionic 2 to build apps that you're going to submit to the App Store, basically. Obviously, have a play around, but until that point, you wouldn't recommend using it?
No. I use Ionic 1. It's out there. It's stable. It's been tested. It's a thing to do. It's what you should be using. Ionic 2, yes, take a look at it. Figure out, is this something that you would want to be interested in to upgrade your app. Start looking in maybe other technologies to ease that transition or some of the best practices that are out there. John Papa's style guide for how to structure an Angular app is probably the best place to go for information on how you structure an app so that way it's upgradable. And the series of videos that I've been doing that I'm doing for TypeScript and Ionic 1, the end goal of that is that we have an Ionic 1 app that is written in TypeScript and becomes super simple to convert to the Ionic 2 equivalent. So
yeah, I'll provide links to everything you just mentioned there in the description for this. I guess for people who are new to Ionic now, from what I've heard, basically Ionic 1 is going to continue to be supported, you know, for quite a long time, basically, as long as people are using it. So would you say if, you know, people are kind of scared of this Ionic 2 approach, or they don't like the look of it, and they just want to stick with Ionic 1, do you think that is something that is feasible in the long term? Do you think if they want to stay on Ionic 1 for the next 3 years or something like that, do you think that's something they could do, or would you recommend at some point trying to make that transition into Ionic 2?
I think at some point I'd recommend trying to make that transition. There's some core changes in the framework itself that are better for performance, allow for more flexibility. So if you have any kind of hacks that you're doing currently, you know, it could be stuff that we've already taken care of. I know a common one is being able to create a modal with sub-navigations inside that modal. And people have been doing hacks to get that to work in Ionic 1. But with Ionic 2, stuff like that is trivial. Having sub-navigations inside of your side menu, same thing. I'd really push people to look into switching to Ionic 2 once it becomes viable.
Yeah. So it seems to me like the best approach now is, I guess, if you're new to Ionic now, learn Ionic 1, build stuff with Ionic 1. If you're already using it, keep building stuff with Ionic 1. Start having to play around with Ionic 2, and then when that beta release comes, then look at switching over to it. So I'll look at wrapping this up now. For everyone listening, if you haven't already followed Mike, he's on Twitter at @mhartington. You can find him there. Was there anything else you wanted to mention, Mike, or anything you wanted to shout out at all?
I guess take a look at Ionic, Ionic 2, the website ionic.io/2. We want your feedback. We want to make sure that we want people to know that we care about what your opinion is of the framework. So if you think there are places where we can improve or that you don't like the syntax, the repo is open. Make an issue. Let us know. And we're heavily active in there every single day. So
yeah,
we want your opinion on it.
And yeah, I think that's maybe something people forget sometimes is that you can contribute directly to Ionic 2 if you want to submit a pull request or help with the docs, that kind of stuff. Everyone can contribute. So
yeah, we've already had a pull request, a couple pull requests merged. So people, send your pull requests.
Awesome. All right, cool. Thanks, Eats, for coming on, Mike.
No problem.
Okay, that brings episode 2 to a close. Please do still keep sending in all of your feedback. Let me know what you want to see on this show, who you want to see on here. Should I be talking more about some things, less about some things? Let me know so I can make this show as good as possible. So I'll see you in the next episode, and have an awesome day.